Money 105.5 presents Money 2.0.
Money 2.0.
Now, from Rogerson Business Services, certified business broker, Andrew Rogerson on Money 2.0.
If you're out and about and listening and you hear something of interest, you're welcome to visit my website, www.rogersonbusinessservices.com. Each show is recorded, available on the website, and just go there. There's a media tab. Click on the media tab. There's a little drop-down. It says 105.5 FM and Money 2.0. Click on that, and it'll take you to each of the shows that have been recorded. And there's now about 34 shows, so lots of good content there. If you have an interest, to go back and listen to my guests, they're all experts in their areas, and there's a range of subjects. And that's the purpose of this show. The purpose of this show is to talk about people that are looking to sell a business, buy a business, or buy a franchise. And these topics include finance, legal issues, tax, accounting, as well as sales and marketing. Or as I say, this show is where Wall Street meets Main Street. My name is Andrew Rogerson. I'm a certified business broker and the host of your show. I'm certified through the California Association of Business Brokers, and I'm also certified with International Business Brokers Association. I'm the author of four books: Successfully Start Your Business, Successfully Buy Your Business, Successfully Buy Your Franchise, and then, when it's time to get out, Successfully Sell Your Business. If you'd like more, you're welcome to visit my website, again, www.rogersonbusinessservices.com, or give me a call, 916-570-2674. Each week I like to mention a charity. As I like to say, the world doesn't get better without people giving to charities. And so if you're here in Sacramento and you're into food, there's an event coming up. It's on Friday, October the 4th. It's called A Taste of Sacramento. It's actually its 15th year. All the proceeds from the event go to Easter Seals, and Easter Seals are a great service in our community, helping people with disabilities. So the show's on, the event's on Friday, October the 4th from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. It's at the Sacramento Convention Center. The tickets cost $40 in advance, or if you want to buy tickets on the day of the event, it's they go up to $60. So it's unlimited sampling of food, wine, and beer. There's raffles and there's a silent auction, so lots of things happening. So it's Friday the 4th of October, 5:30 to 9 p.m. If you want more information, give them a call, 916-808-5181, and you must be over 21 years old to get into the event. I like to blog, like to inform people, educate people, and a blog I just wrote: if for somebody owning a business and thinking of selling, you may be asked the question if you're interested in doing seller finance. Well, I've written a blog and it covers 26 seller finance options. So again, you're welcome to visit my website, go to my blog, and get some more information if you're interested in seller finance. So my first guest is Graham Plant. And as I mentioned, Graham specializes in M&A, but he also is an angel investor, or he's been active in the angel investing community. And I bump into people who have a business and they're looking to get finance, and they ask, you know, is an angel investing a good option for me to consider? So I thought I'd bring Graham onto the show and talk to Graham and get his thoughts. So, Graham, good morning. You're there.
Good morning. I am here.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. So before we get into the angel investing piece, tell me a little bit about Graham Plant and what you do in your spare time.
Well, in my spare time, I spend a lot of time outdoors. I ride my bike. I kayak some on the local rivers in the foothills. I do a little bit of cross-country skiing and downhill skiing. And then lately, this summer, I've actually been doing a lot of hiking in the Sierras. We just got back from a couple trips down south near Bishop and Mammoth, and
yep,
the fall colors are coming in. It's really spectacular down there.
You weren't hit by the fire going through Yosemite?
No, the smoke was blowing north, so we were out of the way of that.
Yeah, it's pretty intense, that whole Yosemite fire. Just huge.
Oh, yeah.
Area. It's just amazing. So by education, you're a mechanical engineer. You've got a degree from UC Davis, and you also have an MBA from Berkeley. Have I got that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I got my engineering degree because I'm sort of a natural numbers kind of guy, math guy. But I found when I was in the early part of my career that I was attracted to a lot of the business elements. So I then went to Berkeley and spent a couple of years getting my MBA in marketing and finance.
And Graham and I have something in common. We both spent time at HP, at Hewlett-Packard. We didn't meet each other when we worked there because it's a big campus, but Graham has worked at HP and had some good experiences there. I've got that right. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was there for 9 years at the Roseville campus.
Yep.
working in the networking division.
Yep. So what attracted you to the world of buying and selling of businesses? What drew you into that world?
I had some opportunities to invest in some small companies, usually with associates that I worked with. I had been getting sort of more and more interested in the deal side of business. After I was at HP, I went to a startup, and one of the competencies of that company was raising money, and I sat near the guy who did the money raising, the CFO, and I just found I was really intrigued with what he was doing. And then I invested in a couple small companies that people who had been at that first startup went off and did on their own, so I put some money into some of those, and I've been kind of doing it off and on ever since.
So you've touched different places. You've been involved in startups, and I know you worked at Compass Point Capital, which specializes in M&A, and you're currently working at Woodbridge International, which again is really dealing with the high-end M&A market. Some of the transactions you guys are dealing with, 30, 40, 50, $100 million transactions. So you've covered the gamut from the startup right through to these large transactions you're handling.
Yeah, and actually, the way we split our work is my partner and I were deal makers for the Woodbridge Group and doing the bigger deals, and then we do smaller deals with our local firm called Compass Point Capital. So we can cover a pretty broad range between the two of them.
Yep, and again, all the background you've had with your degrees and your MBA from Berkeley and the experience you had with HP and all the setup, it all rolls up and to give you a great area of expertise. So I thought we'd have a conversation about angel investing because, it's a form of finance that I hear people talking about, but I think it's fairly obscure to most people. So I thought just having a conversation around angel investing was a good thing to do. What's the attraction of angel investing? For somebody that has a business, they need some finance, so their attraction is getting money. But for an angel investor, what's of interest to them?
There are a couple different aspects that are attractive. One is we can make some money too, so that's kind of number one. But sure. There's also an element of the excitement of being involved in with an entrepreneur and giving some advice, a little bit of a give back to the community. If you've had some successes and we're getting good advice from people, then it's a good thing to turn around and give some advice and some money to some other people who are trying to do what maybe you've done already.
So how would you define angel investing? Is there a simple way of putting a label on it in terms of what it is?
Yeah, it is a little hard to label exactly, and it's probably easiest to illustrate if you kind of look at the progression of how a company gets funded. Generally, the way people do it is, you have an idea or, some thought about a business you want to start, and usually you'll first turn to your own savings account and then maybe some friends and family. And the term used for that is friends, fools, and family. So those are the very, very earliest investors when it's really just an idea in somebody's head.
Right.
And then kind of the next stage when you start going outside of your immediate circle of friends and family is to angel investors. So they're the first people that you might bring your concept to or your business to, depending on kind of how far through development you are. So they're the first ones you talk to outside of that immediate circle of people. And so it's the first ones you'll probably have to write a business plan for, have some financial projections for. And again, it's usually not huge amounts of money, but enough to bring a company along pretty far. And so there's the angel brings money, and they also bring advice and maybe some connections. They might be able to help, get some employees. Maybe you need a CEO, or maybe you need a CFO. Your angel investors might be able to help provide some of that. And then the next stage beyond that is usually venture capital. So angels fit between friends and family and venture capitalists.
Okay, Graham, we're going to take a break. We're going to be gone for a couple of minutes, but my guest this morning is Graham Plant. He works for Woodbridge Group and Compass Point Capital, but we're talking about angel investing, and I've got some more questions for Graham when we come back from break.
Money 2.0 is sponsored by Rogerson Business Services.
Call Money 1055 at 866-576-1055 and get your questions answered in real time right now on Money 2.0.
Are you a business owner or entrepreneur at heart? I am too. I'm Andrew Rogerson, a local business broker and host of Money 2.0. Listen live Tuesdays at 10 on Money 105.5 FM. Let's talk about how you can successfully run your business.
Tune in to Money 2.0 with Andrew Rogerson, certified business broker and author of 4 books, Successfully Start Your Business, Buy Your Business, Buy Your Franchise, and Successfully Sell Your Business. Hear Andrew Rogerson on Money 2.0 live, 10 a.m. Tuesdays, right here on Money 105.5 FM.
Millions of children in America go to bed hungry. Kids in your city. Kids like Javier. 3-year-old Javier loves his toys, all of which are donated by a local church. His mother, Vanessa, is completely worn out trying to make ends meet for her family. At the end of the week, very little money is left to pay bills and buy groceries, and Vanessa receives no government assistance. But Vanessa has found help and hope from a local food pantry that is served by Feed the Children. For 34 years, Feed the Children has been helping families get through the hard times. Each $5 you give is multiplied 5 times to provide $25 worth of food and essentials for struggling families across the U.S. $75 will provide $375 worth of food and essentials. You can help feed America's children like Javier with a gift of just $75. To donate, call 800-925-9745. That's 800-925-9745.
Money experts, every morning at 10 on Money 2.0. Now, back to the host, Andrew Rogerson.
Welcome back, and thank you for listening to 105.5 FM and Money 2.0. I'm the host of the show, Andrew Rogerson, and my guest this morning is Graham Plant. And Graham and I are having a conversation around angel investing. And before we went to break, Graham was talking about the investment criteria for somebody starting a business is to touch their savings account, talk to friends, fools, and families, and then once they get through those, look to an angel investor. So, do angel investors need to be licensed, Graham, to provide investing?
No, generally, they should be accredited investors, and depending on sort of where you get involved, there's a sort of a gray line between the friends and family round and the angel round. And some of the friends and family rounds you can do without being accredited due to your intimacy, your knowledge of the person who's running the company or your knowledge of the business. But when you're truly an angel where there's kind of an arm's length relationship, then generally these are accredited investors.
Okay. And if someone's listening to the show and they're looking to borrow some money, what's the typical process they would go through? Is there such a thing as a typical process, or does it vary with each borrower?
It wouldn't be a loan, so there wouldn't be borrowing involved. It's usually an equity investment, because usually at the angel level there isn't a cash flow to service debt, so it's usually an equity investment. Okay. The general process is to go find a local angel group, and there are groups kind of all over the place. There's the Sacramento Angels locally. There's the Sierra Angels up in Incline Village, and the Bay Area, there are several angel groups like North Bay Angels and Silicon Valley Angels.
Okay. And are these places easy to find? Just a matter of doing a search on the web and doing a search for Sacramento Angel Investing and something would pop up?
Yeah. Yeah, you'd probably find Sacramento Angels if you searched on Angel Investing Sacramento, or if you just did a search on Angel Investments or Angel Investing. You might also come across the Kauffman Foundation, and that's a great resource for people looking for entrepreneurship kind of information. And I believe on their site they have a full list of all kinds of angel groups all over the country.
And what's the background? The Kauffman Foundation, was that put together by?
I don't know the answer to that.
No,
but
fine.
I think it's the Merriman Ewing. I can't remember. The Kauffman Foundation, I think, was the Kauffman family, and I think they're very successful in business. But I don't know which one.
Is it K A U F M A N? Have I got that right?
Kauffman? That's correct. Yep.
Okay. Good. All right. Does angel investing tend to revolve around one industry, or is it diverse with the areas that will help entrepreneurs?
There's probably more tech investing than anything else, and that I may have a little bit of a biased view being on the West Coast. So right. Somebody in Chicago may say, "Oh, there's plenty of investing in other industries," but I think the tech world probably gets more angel attention than anything else.
And as an angel investor, you've done some of this investing. Do you have a risk tolerance for investing a certain amount of money? How do you manage your risk as an angel investor?
There's a lot of gut feel involved, but there's usually we're looking for a good solid plan. But most important, what we're looking for is a really solid team. Those early investments, you really need to have a good sense that this team is not only on the right path, but then when that path goes bad, they'll be able to, the current term is pivot to something new. People need to be able to respond. And most businesses that are early stage like this, they make several big changes in their strategic plan along the way.
So a typical business model would be somebody that's invented the idea, and then hopefully they put together a couple of experts in terms of somebody with some finance or some accounting background. So they've got that element taken care of. They've got the management piece taken care of, and there's a clear vision on the direction of the company and where it's going. Then is that at a simple level?
Yeah, basically. You want to be able to build a plan that shows that I can produce my product, I can develop the product, I can market the product. Someone's going to buy it, and they're going to pay me enough money that it covers my costs and leaves me some room for some profit. They want to show that there is a big market that you're going to go after. Sort of the standard pieces of a business plan you've got to really have in order before an angel's going to get very seriously invested.
In a sense, it sounds a bit like Shark Tank. It sounds like what you see on Shark Tank. I don't know whether you've watched
exactly.
The show.
Yeah, that's basically a mini version of what you'd expect to see in an angels meeting, but not without the drama.
Yeah, well, the drama is all condensed down to a TV show. But I had one guy on the show back in April, I think it was, who was actually on Shark Tank, and he invented a tech product. It was a mobile speaking product. And he was on the Shark Tank. He was a young guy, and he's about 26, 27, I think, at the time. And he's with a couple of partners. They've just blown this roof off this mobile speaker business they've put together. And it's just intriguing, the process he went through. And he went on Shark Tank and got some interest from one of the guys. And apparently the Shark Tank rules are that if they make an offer and you accept it, you don't need to go with that Shark Tank investor until the product goes live. So he actually used the experience of talking to the Shark Tank investor and gaining some knowledge, and then he chose not to go with him. So because he hadn't actually taken the product to market, he was in the process of ramping things up. So interesting world with it. It's very dynamic. Just what you're saying, Graeme. You've got to be prepared to pivot and make changes. And so that creative entrepreneur element is really critical to being able to maximize the opportunity and as it comes to you.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you mentioned that he learned from that experience. And that's one thing that in any kind of meeting in front of an investor, you'll generally learn a lot. So getting meetings, if you can get the meetings with the angels, you'll usually come away with some advice and some interesting pointers. They may not invest with you, but generally the experience is valuable just getting in front of the people so that you can present the plan and they can give you some feedback, and you might go off and do a pivot right then, because they may say, there's no market for that product, but here's where you could actually, if you made these changes, you could sell it in this area.
It's intriguing. Yeah, I love the whole thing being so dynamic. So what's, just in simple terms, if somebody was to find an angel investor and be attracted to make a presentation, what would be the normal course of things? Are they looking at a 2 or 3 or 4 month process, or is it quicker than that? Or what? Just walk me through some of the steps that somebody that's looking for an angel investor would go through in terms of making. And just walk me through the process, just at a simple level.
Sure. Well, let's say that you get a hold of an angel group, and usually you make an application and you submit some level of your plan. they're going to look for sort of fundamental things in that plan to make sure that it's worth spending time on. And there's a lot of kooky stuff that comes into these groups. So I'd say, you know, the majority gets thrown out. But, you know, if you have a good plan and it shows that there's money to be made, then, you know, you might make it through that first screening, and then there'll be another committee that may look at it, and then they pick a few for a meeting. So, for instance, I think Sacramento Angels meets monthly, so they might have two or three presentations per meeting. So if you happen to be one of those that gets into the meeting, you go into the meeting and you present your plan in front of the group. There's usually, you know, a presentation period and then some Q&A, and then they thank you for that. And then after the meeting, if there were, say, you know, 20 people in the room, they'll sort of get a show of hands of who's interested in a deal. And so maybe four or five are interested in the deal, and they'll then get together to talk about that deal and divide up the work of some due diligence. And so they'll, you know, someone will look into the financial side, someone might look into the market opportunity, someone else might look into the, you know, the technology being developed, for instance. And so they're going to drill in more deeply and be asking a lot of questions of the entrepreneur in their specific areas. And then they're going to meet again and make some decisions about whether any of them in the group want to invest. And then they'll probably usually sort of give the results of what they found to all the members at large to see if anybody else wants to invest. And that's generally, you know, a couple of months getting through that process. And then, you know, another, you know, month or two to get money actually into the bank account for the company.
And is there an investment range that that an angel investor would typically consider, or is it just really a function of the idea and the quality idea?
There are a number of variables. One is the opportunity. You know, what does it need, and how big an opportunity is it? And then another big piece is the capacity of the people investing. I know of some billionaire angel investors in the Bay Area that they write, you know, multi-$100,000 checks.
Wow.
But more typically it's sort of $10,000 to $50,000that any one person might invest, and then they may invest in a team, so you might get a couple $100,000 in the round. All the way down to a friend of mine, he quote-unquote invested in a company by giving the entrepreneur a PC to help him get going.
Wow.
So it's really all across the board.
Across the board, yeah. And that's intriguing. Part of what you're saying is the angel investors can work in groups. So just like on Shark Tank, sometimes the investors do come together. And that's what you're suggesting as well, that a way for an angel investor to bring more value and to spread their risk is to team with other angel investors. And I'm sure
right. That
diversity helps the inventor as well, or the creator of the idea, because they're bringing in different skill sets, and those combined skill sets with the idea of the original idea, it just takes things to a new level.
Absolutely. And it's actually not even just the combination of different angels in a group. Sometimes groups will combine. So
wow.
I know there have been some deals that the SAC angels have done with the Sierra angels. So you might get people from both angel group joining together, so you can really, you know, build a pretty broad list of investors. And I've invested in a company where the first set of investors was a group from San Diego, and then we came in as kind of a second round of angels, and our group was pretty much all Sacramento and Bay Area people. So and having that diversity of viewpoints, like you said, it's very good for the entrepreneur, because it's just more people to bounce ideas off, more advice, more expertise.
Graham, I got to jump in there. We're out of time. I really appreciate you spending time with me talking about angel investing. If people are listening, you've got the Kauffman Foundation to head to, and otherwise do a search for angel investing Sacramento and see what you find. We've got to go. Thanks, Graham, for your time. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
Money 2.0 is sponsored by Rogerson Business Services.
Call Money 1055 at 866-576-1055 and get your questions answered in real time right now on Money 2.0.
U.S. stocks advance. From Bloomberg World Headquarters in New York, I'm Donna Wilson. U.S. stocks rose, snapping a three-day drop in the S&P 500 index, as data showing a drop in consumer confidence was overshadowed by President Obama's comments that eased concern over Middle East tensions. Home builders gained 4% as a group after a report showed home prices increased by the most in more than 7 years, and Lennar's profit beat analysts' estimates. Applied Materials advanced 7.3% after agreeing to buy Tokyo Electron for about $9 billion in stock. But Red Hat fell 11% after second quarter billings trailed estimates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 24 points to 15,425. S&P 500 Index up 0.2% to 1705. And the NASDAQ gained 0.4% to 3783. That's a Bloomberg Market Minute.
Hi, everybody. This is Eric Ilofsky McKay, host of Real Life Lending, every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. on Money 105.5. I know that you're all tired of mortgage company ads telling you how low their rates are. Well, I'm not going to quote a rate that very few folks will qualify for. What I will do is take the time to find the best loan program for you and your family. Whether your FICO is 800 or 600, I'll take the time to provide you real options based on your current financial situation. Let my 20-plus years of experience work for you. Essex Mortgage has been a direct lender for over 26 years, and the best part is that we make all lending decisions in-house because we are the bank. If you're looking to refinance or purchase using a conventional FHA or VA loan, give me a call. Work directly with me, Eric McKay at Essex Mortgage at 916-806-0606. That's 916-806-0606. And don't forget to call in with your questions to Real Life Lending every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. on Money 105.5.
Essex Mortgage is an equal housing lender. NMLS 70377. DRE 996013. DOC 607-3343. Eric McKay, NMLS 288343.
Family, quality, sustainability. Three words that tell the Twisted Roots winery philosophy. And when you savor one of the award-winning wines, you'll taste the fruits of three generations. Wine tasters from all over prefer their 2009 Cabernet Sauvignon, winner of a gold medal and Best of Lodi Appellation in the 2012 California State Fair Wine Competition, and the 2010 Cabernet Sauvignon gold medal winner at the 2013 San Francisco Chronicles Wine Competition. Twisted Roots Wine. In four delicious varietals, Chardonnay, Cabernet Sauvignon, Petite Syrah, and Old Vine Zinfandel. Taste their fine wines at Estate Crush in Lodi or at Lion's Head Art Gallery in Carmel Valley. Club Twisted members get 3 2-bottle shipments a year for $65 plus tax. Twisted Roots wines are available at Total Wines in Folsom, Roseville, and Sacramento, or from their website, twistedrootsvineyard.com. Twisted Roots Wines. Family. Quality. Sustainability.
Are you a business owner or entrepreneur at heart? I am too. I'm Andrew Rogerson, a local business broker and host of Money 2.0. Listen live Tuesdays at 10 on Money 105.5 FM. Let's talk about how you can successfully run your business.
Tune in to Money 2.0 with Andrew Rogerson, certified business broker and author of 4 books, Successfully Start Your Business, Buy Your Business, Buy Your Franchise, and Successfully Sell Your Business. Hear Andrew Rogerson on Money 2.0 live 10 a.m. Tuesdays right here on Money 105. 5.5 FM.
Money Experts, every morning at 10 on Money 2.0. Now, back to the host, Andrew Rogerson.
Welcome back, and thank you for listening to 105.5 FM and Money 2.0. I'm the host of the show, Andrew Rogerson, and my second guest for the show this morning is a young lady called Donna Sauter. And Donna currently works at Ulson & Company, and she specializes in doing tax. So we're getting close to the start of the tax planning season, so I thought it'd be fun to have Donna come on talk to us about some tax planning tips and lots of other things. Tax I find very confusing, so I thought having somebody intelligent to come on the show and talk about it was a good idea. And so I invited Donna to come on, and she said yes. So, Donna, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thank you for coming here, Donna. You currently work at Ulson & Company. How long have you been there, and tell me what you do there.
So I've been with Olson for about 2 years now, and I head up the tax department. So I do, obviously, the easy things, the compliance, making sure all the tax returns get prepared on a timely basis. But I also do a lot of consulting, meaning the planning throughout the years, meeting with clients, meeting with potential new clients to see if there's anything that we can offer them to help with their business and run their business. And then the last thing that I spend a fair amount of time is the tax controversy. So once someone is audited or receives a notice, handling that for them as well.
So the tax world is incredibly confusing. What was the attraction? Why did you want to be a tax person?
Well, actually, I think it's because it was incredibly confusing. Many years ago, about 25 years ago, I took my tax information to a preparer that I had prepared the return myself, and then they charged me for it. And I said, oh my gosh, I could do this. And that's what made me finish my schooling and get my CPA.
Wow. Okay. That's intriguing because the tax is just so complicated. And even going back 25 years, it was still complicated back then.
It was still complicated then, but it's fun for me. It's a challenge, and I like that challenge to be able to figure out how we can solve a problem. I'm a problem solver, and I really enjoy going in, finding out how each situation might be different and how the tax law can apply to help that situation.
Yep. And part of what you do, you're involved in preparing taxes. That's part of what you do? And
that's a big part of what we do, yes.
Okay. All right. Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, as I mentioned at the start of the conversation with Donna, tax planning's coming up to us, and so I thought it'd be fun to have some conversations around different tax things. And the listeners to the show are business owners or those thinking into getting into business. So I thought one of the some of the things we should talk about is the different taxes and how they affect different entrepreneurs at different stage of their entrepreneurial journey. So somebody starting a business has a different tax need to somebody who's in the throes of running their business and doing very well, as opposed to somebody who's thinking of getting out and selling their business. They've got different tax strategies and different needs. So if somebody's thinking of starting a business, Donna, they've got to choose the right legal entity. That's part of what they've got to get right. But as well, in that process of choosing the right entity, they've got to get the right tax as well. So how do you help somebody in that situation?
That's correct. And it's very important to I have a phrase, don't let the tax tail wag the dog.
Good.
You don't want to make your decision strictly based on tax, but you need to be informed of what the tax consequences are so that you can make an informed decision. So it's not just tax, it's legal, it's personal. There's a lot of other things that go along with that decision. But you should know what the selection of your entity, what that will mean to you short term in a tax consequence, as well as potentially long term.
And it's challenging because when you're starting a business, you're not quite sure if the business is going to survive, or if you think it's definitely going to survive, you're not quite sure where the business is going to end up and what the right tax entity is, or the right entity is for the tax consequences.
So a lot of new businesses prepare a business plan. That's how they get started. And it's usually 3 to 5 years out what they expect. And they're usually working with some other people, maybe friends and family, like you mentioned on your earlier part of your show, potentially angel investors.
Yep.
But they need to have, a brand new business should have some sort of an idea. This is what I expect it to be like. Now, will it be that? No, it'll be different. But at least it's a plan and place to start.
Yep. And that's what I'm picking up from you, which is very good. So if somebody was to come and sit down to you and say, Donna, I'm thinking of starting a business, or I've started a business 2 weeks ago and I need to choose an entity, you'd say, okay, where's your business plan? Let's go through that business plan and we'll see if we can scope out where you need to be.
Right. And what kind of owners? Is it one person? Is it 10 people? Is it partnerships? All of that might go into play with what your options are.
Okay. And so I'm going to put you on the spot here. What are the three biggest mistakes you see a person starting their business? What are the three biggest mistakes you see?
So I can tell you one big mistake that I've seen a number of times just in this past year. People thinking that they have a particular type of entity and they don't. Ah. So for instance, an S corporation. Many of us, new businesses, small business owners, know what an S corporation is.
Right.
You have to actually actively elect an S corporation status by filling out a form and timely filing it. People are not doing that correctly or not doing it at all. And then they find out 2-3 years later that they're really not an S corporation.
Wow. So they're filing as a corporation thinking, okay, I filed as a corporation with the Secretary of State. I've done all I need to do.
They think they're done.
They're good to go, and they've only done
A lot of them are going online, creating their own documents. And, of course, because they're not an accountant or they're not an attorney, they don't know all of the other documents.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the key, is not seeking out the professional advice in advance.
Right.
Yes, it costs money. And yes it costs your time.
Right.
But from my perspective, as a professional, you need to invest that time and that money in order to make sure from the get-go you're not creating a big problem that you're going to have to spend more money and more time unwinding later.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's what's the downside? I mean, the difference between a C corp and an S corp. I have a C and I have an S corp, so I'm kind of
so you're a little familiar,
a little bit familiar with it. But you know,
so there's a huge downside. An S corporation, as you probably know, pays no federal tax as a general rule. There's always exceptions, of course,
sure.
But as a general rule, pays no federal tax and a very small state tax if you're in California.
Right.
A C corporation pays federal tax and state tax,
right.
And then in order to get that income that the C corporation makes to the individual, it's taxed again. So the
right.
C corporations can have what we hear, that double tax.
Yep.
An S corporation has a very, very, very small double tax.
Tax. Yeah. And one of the sad parts about all this is you can't change your mind and say, okay, I start as a C corp, I want to change my mind and become an S corp. You can
change your mind, but there's steps that you have to go through, hoops that you have to jump through, and you can actually, there's procedures now where you can go back and retroactively correct your mistake.
Right.
If you qualify and if you get either a professional to do it for you, or
yep.
you do a lot of research and figure it out. So you can correct it within a certain time period.
Right.
But a lot of times you don't even realize it until some people I'm noticing, they realize it when they go to sell their business.
Right.
And then that's a disaster because the whole plan has changed.
Changed, yeah. Well, I guess part of what I was trying to say is you can't keep changing your mind. So if you start as a C corp and move to an S corp and then decide you want to become back a C corp again, the IRS doesn't like that.
Yeah, they don't like that. There are rules that I believe it's... You're getting me on the spot here, but I believe it's
yep.
5 years before you can change back. So
okay.
it's a bit of a time commitment.
Exactly, yeah, because the IRS wants to see, there's tax rules that apply to each entity, and they want to see the consistency. Otherwise, if people kept flipping and flopping...
they don't want you to change because it's more tax advantageous
yes.
1 year and
yes.
less tax advantageous the next year. They don't want that changing back
no.
and forth. Absolutely.
No, they give you some benefits for different reasons, but yeah, so okay. So I asked you the three biggest mistakes. You gave me one. Have you got a couple more or not?
So some of the other big mistakes that I'm seeing for new entities is they wait until the tax return is due and then seek the advice of a professional.
Right.
Okay, my tax return is due. Their books are not up to date. Their
right.
plan is not up to date. They haven't been saving adequate money to make the tax payments if they are. And
yep.
of course, maybe we should clarify this is income tax
yep.
Based. But a lot of... putting it off until the last minute because new business owners are so busy running
yes.
their business.
Yes.
They have their talent, they have their product, they have their service, whatever it is, and
yep.
that's what they're good at.
Yep.
Going home and doing the books at the end of the day is the last thing on their mind. And
yep.
when they wait and a year has gone by and it's tax time, sometimes the deadlines are different. They don't even realize it.
Right.
They haven't been making their payments on time because they're not aware of that.
Yep.
That can be a big snowball that now you're on this hamster wheel where you're trying to
right.
get caught up with last year and yet
yep.
you're incurring this year as well.
Yep. So the tax deadline is the end of the year in terms of doing a lot of things. There are things you can do after the tax year, but what you're focusing on is that you know, really, if your calendar year is your tax year, then you've got to have things in place before the end of the year. You can't leave it till January, February to go back and do changes. You can do some little adjustments, but the bucket has to be taken care of in the current year.
It should be. It absolutely should be. You can't do planning without knowing where you're at.
Right.
So you need to keep up with that. You know, my advice would be weekly, but you need to keep up with that at least monthly, quarterly at a very minimum, so that you can. Know where you're at.
Right.
Know what your expectations are for a cash flow. I mean,
yep.
cash is king.
Yep.
You definitely need
yeah.
to make sure that you have the adequate cash set aside. The last thing you want to do as a new business is get behind
right.
in any kind of taxes, payroll taxes, income taxes.
Yep.
It's just a big snowball.
Yep. And any third and final?
So the third and final is what I'm noticing a lot of new businesses do is when they have their new investors, whether it be their friends, their family, their buddy from college,
right.
you know, they have this very loose, who's going to be the owner, who's going to do what. It's not written out. It's all on a handshake. And then at the end of the day, when the tax return's getting prepared, it all falls out that it's a little bit different than what everybody expected and what people wrote in.
Yep.
So that it's very important that people document that and understand it going into it.
Yep. I think we're coming up to a break. Donna, my guest this morning is Donna Sauter. Donna's with Ulson & Company here in Sacramento. Her phone number is 916-563-7790. Let's take a break, and when you come back from break, I've got some more questions for you about tax. So thank you for being a guest here this morning, Donna.
Money 2.0 is sponsored by Rogerson Business Services.
Call Money 1055 at 866-576-1055 and get your questions answered in real time right now. on Money 2.0.
Are you a business owner or entrepreneur at heart? I am too. I'm Andrew Rogerson, a local business broker and host of Money 2.0. Listen live Tuesdays at 10 on Money 105.5 FM. Let's talk about how you can successfully run your business.
Tune in to Money 2.0 with Andrew Rogerson, certified business broker and author of 4 books, Successfully Start Your Business, Buy Your Business, Buy Your Franchise, and Successfully Sell Your Business. Hear Andrew Rogerson on Money 2.0 live, 10 a.m. Tuesdays, right here on Money 105.5 FM.
Before you put solar panels on your roof, you must contact Sunrise Roofing. When solar panels are attached properly to your roof, holes must be drilled. Sunrise Roofing is an expert in solar and is one of few companies that specialize in both roofing and solar. Most solar companies are not roofing experts. Doesn't it make sense to hire someone who is an expert in both? Listen to what Terry has to say.
So last fall, my 20-year-old house needed a new roof, but we wanted to get solar as well. So I talked to a friend of mine and he mentioned Sunrise Roofing. They were really professional. They were on time. Their work was really good. It was top quality. In addition to that, they filled out all the paperwork for my utility upfront rebate. Their rates were really good. They were competitive. I couldn't be happier with the work they did, and I would refer them to all the homeowners out there.
The Sunrise Roofing and Solar team has decades of experience. Whether you need a re-roof, are interested in solar, or thinking of doing both, call today before the rebates expire for a free consultation. 635-3000, 635-3000, or go online to sunrisesolarroofing.com.
Money experts, every morning at 10. On Money 2.0. Now, back to the host, Andrew Rogerson.
Welcome back, and thank you for listening to 105.5 FM and Money 2.0. I'm the host of the show, Andrew Rogerson, and my guest this morning is Donna Sauter. Donna's with Utzon & Company here in Sacramento, and Donna heads up the tax department at Utzon & Co. So she knows all about taxes, and so that's the context of my conversation this morning with her, is talking about taxes and how they impact small businesses. Before the break, we were talking about some tax advice for people starting a business. Now I thought we'd have a conversation about those that are in business, that are doing well and the business is operating and successful, and they need some help with tax planning as well. So, Donna, if I've had a business, maybe it's 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 years old, whatever it is, and it's doing very well, what are some of the tax things I could be doing better that you've seen from some of the conversations you've had with some of your clients?
So I've been doing this for over 22 years, and I've worked with the largest accounting firm in the world as well as now a local firm, and I've seen a lot of different things. One common theme has always been when you have a new business and they start up, things go usually pretty smoothly for the first 3 to 5 years.
Right.
But at some point in time, they probably outgrow that initial tax preparer and the consultants that they have from the beginning, because they use their friends, their families, and as their business grows, that person may not be experienced enough and have enough education in order to, you know, to grow with them.
Sure.
They need to reevaluate. Do I need to change my professional advisors? Do I need to bring on somebody new? I'll give you a perfect example. This is a dramatic example, but I had this very situation. They'd been around for years, and a colleague of mine had done a little bit of sales tax work and said, you need to meet Donna. I went in, talked to him for an hour. He said, oh, our sole practitioner guy is great. He's been wonderful. And I said, can I just look at your tax return for a minute after listening for an hour?
Sure.
And then I said, read this question number 12, and what's the answer? He says, yes. I said, but you didn't mark yes. You marked no. That's a $10,000 fine by missing that box and not putting the appropriate forms with the return every year that was missed. And it's just because they moved into international waters and did not know the rules. Yeah. And so I was able to go back and get it cleaned up, and they didn't have to pay that penalty and that fine. But had the IRS fixed it or noticed it first, they could have been in a world of hurt. Pickle. So you need to make sure that your advisors are qualified as you grow, that they're qualified to serve you.
Yep, that's really good advice, because I can understand that. You know, if you start a business and you're doing, you know, $100,000 a year in gross sales, and all of a sudden next year it's $200,000 and $300,000
and $1 million and $5 million.
The game changes.
The tax change. And the dollars get bigger, and you have a lot more at risk.
Yep.
And yes, it's nice to be loyal. I think loyalty has a very important place in our businesses.
Sure.
But at some point in time, they need to be loyal to you too, and say, you know, you've grown too big. I can't help you.
Yep. I like the advice. I'm doing a tax class right now at American River College, and it's on corporations and partnerships and LLCs. And the tax complexity does change as you grow. So you're making perfect sense to me. So
and the laws change too year to year to year. And if your practitioner's been doing this for 40 years and they're not keeping up with it, it's still your responsibility as the business owner to make sure that your returns and that your reports are correct.
Yep. So you gave me one thing that a business owner could do better. What a couple of other things that come to mind?
So a couple of other things that come to mind is being proactive versus reactive. And we talked a little bit about that with the new business, but you also want to do that with your existing business. Go back and reevaluate. Have I been doing the same things the same way for the past 5 years? What could I do different?
Yep.
And I am not afraid to have my client come to me and say, let's sit down and talk. What can we do different?
Yep.
How can we make this more efficient? How can I change things? How can I save money? How can I plan for the future? There's a lot of opportunities for them to save money, to be more tax efficient. Maybe you can't reduce your tax liability, but maybe you can do it over a period of time to be more what we call tax efficient. Making sure that you're not making decisions today that are favorable, but will hurt you worse in 3 or 4 or 5 years from now. You need to look at the long-term plan of it.
Yep. And that makes common sense too, because again, things change, and to have you come in and do a review, I don't think it would be a huge amount of time, and the value from that investment, having you come in and do that review, it could be.
It's invaluable, and it's interesting because all of my clients would like to think that I'm at home thinking about them, you know, in my spare time, and coming up ways to help save money.
Yes,
and that would be lovely.
Yes,
but the fact of the matter is, I have other clients,
and
I have my other life, right?
Yes, exactly.
But if they sit and make an appointment with me for an hour, they have my undivided attention. They can tell me what changes they're experiencing in their business, and I can explain to them how the tax law may or may not apply to that.
Yep,
and it might just trigger some other thoughts and some other questions that can be very helpful.
So stay with that theme, because we're kind of talking about tax planning. One of my questions for you was tax planning. We've kind of moved in there, and so I'm intrigued. You know, October's very close, and the end of the tax year won't be too far away. End of the year won't be too far away. If somebody needs to think about, people need to start thinking about tax planning, not right now, but pretty soon. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, you should be doing it all year round. That would be my goal.
Sure.
But we understand that business owners are, again, busy running their business, and that's very important. But they need to not wait until December. They won't get the best and most creative ideas, and they won't have the most time to be able to implement any of those ideas, too, if they wait until the last minute. So October's never too early. Even if it's just a short meeting, here's what we've done, here's what we're buying, here's what we're thinking about buying, or we're going to acquire a business, are we going to sell off a part of our business, buy a building, all of those things can have very serious tax consequences. And then that should be planned before those transactions take place.
So how would you like a business owner to bring this to you? Is there some planning they need to do, or is there a way they can do things to maximize your time and maximize their return on investment by talking to you?
What I really like is for my clients to feel very comfortable calling me up. If they're not comfortable calling me, if they're worried that they're going to get a charge that they don't want to, they're worried about every little dime that they're going to get charged, then they're probably not with the right provider.
Okay.
They should be able to call me and say, hey, we're thinking about buying this building. Is there anything we should think about for a tax perspective?
Okay.
Again, not letting the tax consequence make the decision, but just so that they're informed and they aren't caught by surprise.
Okay.
Or even if they're selling big pieces of their equipment or they're moving. I've got a client that's hundreds of thousands of dollars to move. Are those expense? Or do we capitalize? Well, some of them are one and some of them are another. Meanwhile, they're out $500,000. And if they don't get to take that deduction now, but they have to spread it over 39 years, that's a big cash impact.
Yeah. Okay. So working with Donna, we're kind of talking about the best way to facilitate the planning. So if they're working with you and doing the planning, giving you a call is what you would encourage them to do?
Give me a call, and if it's important enough or strategic enough, then I like to sit down and have a meeting. Sometimes I go to their office and I get to see them at work and they can show me things.
Sure.
But other times it's just as important that they either come to my office or we go off site. They need to be uninterrupted. They need to be focused on the tax planning in order to make it efficient. And if their phone is ringing, their email's dinging away,
they're not paying attention
and they're not as engaged, and we can't really explore all of the options.
We're going to run out of time shortly, but I wanted to touch base quickly on somebody who has a business and they're thinking of selling, because there's a lot of business owners that have held off selling because the economy hasn't been the right time to sell. But for somebody who owns a business and wants to sell, what's a couple of tips you'd give to them?
So I think that there's two major criteria that they need to consider. And one of them is obviously the financial aspect. And it's not just, can I sell it for $5 million, but what's the cash out of that at the end of the day? That's very important that they know going into it and that they're realistic. What is my business worth? And what's my business worth when I'm not involved? Because it's very different without you being there. It's not quite the same business. And then the second piece is the transfer of ownership. Who's going to run the business? And those two things are often at odds with each other. You want your kids maybe to step into the shoes, but they don't have the financial capacity to pay you what it's worth. So I think you need to work with somebody, a professional, again, on that exit planning. And you need to do that 8-10 years out. You don't wait till the year you're ready to sell and retire. You need to plan in advance.
So your comment there about a business owner getting a valuation, I couldn't agree with you more, because that's part of what I do. I help people buy and sell a business. And one of my frustrations is for the seller is the expectation the business is worth a lot of money. And I had an example where I had one gentleman thought his business was worth $1 million. I did an appraisal for him and came in at $110,000. So it was kind of a disappointment to him to have such a little value.
Yeah, it can be very shocking. And then the other thing is they could be selling it for $3 million, but once they pay the tax on that,
yep,
and they're bringing home $1.8 million,
right,
that's not what they thought that they would have to retire on.
Donna, we've got to wrap it up there. I'm so grateful for you coming this morning talking to me. Good to talk about tax. If you're listening, I was talking to Donna Sauter, S-A-U-T-E-R. Donna's at Ultson & Company. That's you can actually go to their website, www.ueltzen.com, or give Donna a call. She, as you can tell, she's very friendly, 916-563-7790. And if you've been listening this morning, thank you for listening to 105.5 FM and Money 2.0. I'm Andrew Rogerson. Out for now. Thank you.